Hello and welcome into this edition of the Golf Show Podcast with Rex and Lav. Well, any suspense about this 153rd Open Championship ended about the minute that Scottie Scheffler stuffed his approach shot in the first hole to a foot at one point up by 8 shots at Royal Portrush. It became a 4-shot snoozer, during which Scotty became the first player in modern major championship history to win each of his first 4 majors by 3 or more shots. Rex, you're still buzzing from that final round of Portrush.
I mean, blowouts normally aren't very entertaining, and certainly the way Scotty took control early, you pointed out that it probably was over when he hit the approach shot into one. It probably sent a message to the rest of the field. I will give a nod to Doug Ferguson, the AP Golf Writer, the dean of golf writers, and his lead was brilliant, and it went something along the lines, I'm going to butcher it a little bit, I apologize, but Scotty Scheffler started the week talking about trying to win majors and, quote, what was the point? And he ended the week with making the rest of the field ask themselves, what's the point? Because the way he plays, when he plays like this, when he is on his game, I think if you combine strokes gained approach, strokes gained putting, he picked up 17 and a half shots on the field for the week. That is just outlandish. That's impossible to wrap your mind around. When you look at when he's playing his best golf, and the ball striking is going to be, That's what we always expect. It's always going to be there. But when he's able to putt like this, this is what's going to happen. He's going to run away with events. And I keep going back to the idea of how other players reacted. That's the best way, I feel like, to gauge when a player gets on a run like this. Bryson DeChambeau, and I quote, he's in a league of his own. Rory McIlroy, and I quote, he is the bar. Matt Fitzpatrick, and I quote, he's in a different class. All of these is just cliche after cliche after cliche, but it's the only way to really explain what he was able to do, the way he continues to do. We're going to get into the Grand Slam talk in a minute, but the idea that we spent the last 2 months, 2.5 months, talking breathlessly about how special it was for Rory McIlroy to complete that Grand Slam, and how we're not going to see this very often, and how we're going to savor it, and the idea that we're less than a year away from Scotty doing it, it was an amazing performance.
It's July 21st, and during a season in which Rory McIlroy won 3 times in the first couple of months of the PGA Tour, won the Players' Championship, won the Masters, Scotty's already wrapped up PGA Tour Player of the Year again for the 4th consecutive year. It's crazy to think about just how much he has supplanted Rory McIlroy as the number one storyline in golf in the year 2025. The only disappointment for me, Rex, on Sunday is that Scottie Scheffler made par on his last 6 holes, because Scotty was very close to joining Tiger Woods and Ben Hogan as the only players to win multiple majors in a season by 5 or more shots. Obviously, the PGA Championship, what had been a tight game, turned into a blowout at Quail Hollow. Again, Scotty was up briefly by 8 shots. He was cruising 6 or 7 shots, ended up making the double on the 8th hole, bounced back on 9. But look, we're talking like Tiger 2000. We're talking Ben Hogan, 1953. Those are the 2 of the greatest seasons in the history of the sport that had those 2 blowouts. I don't know if Scotty's 2025 will ultimately be remembered that way, but it's pretty cool to think that that was the company he nearly joined during a season, again, where his iron play was a little bit off at Augusta. His putter let him down at Oakmont, a very special major championship season, ended, Rex, I think, in a really fitting way here at Portrush.
It really did, and I'm glad you brought that up, because we've had this conversation in the past. I hate this comparison. I hate comparing anyone to Tiger Woods, because it's always unfair to both Tiger Woods and almost always the player that you're trying to compare to Tiger Woods, because he was such a generational player. He did things that no one else could possibly do, but I have sort of broken it down. However, I'm going to muscle through this. I'm going to power through it, and only because, and this is the ultimate compliment. I mean, I think if actually you would have received this compliment, you would have led the show with it. I had to sort of sit in. Todd Lewis and I had to sit in for Live From while the main crew, we're talking about Brandel Chamblee, Rich Lerner, and Paul McGinley. The A team, exactly. They were going down to do the interview with the winner, Scottie Scheffler. And so we had to sit in for a segment, and we were having this conversation. And I went to the idea that the only comp for what Scottie has done this season, and we can go back and start talking about other seasons, is Tiger Woods in 2000. And this is not an apples-to-apple comparison. Please don't at me. I know this is not a perfect comparison, because Tiger won 9 times that season. But if you look at his margin of victory, average margin of victory, Tiger Woods in 2000 in 2000. This is including when he won the U.S. Open at Pebble Beach by 15 strokes. This is including where he had another win by 11 strokes. His average margin of victory was 5.1. Would you like to venture a guess of what Scottie Scheffler's average margin of victory is? I'm not going to allow you to guess. It's 5.2.
5.1. Oh.
No, it's 5.2, which is even better. So as I reported this, as I said this on LiveFM, I was walking off the set, and I actually got a high five from Brandwell about that one's a good one. I didn't think about that. So if nothing else, Scotty won a major, but I feel like I actually won my own major this week as well.
That's a very impressive feat, just to get a high five from Brandwell, the king of stats, the king of analysis on live from. I go back to two recs. So if that's really the case, and clearly it is since you looked it up, but like golf right now, there's supposed to be more parity than ever, right? Equipment is supposed to have leveled the playing field. We're supposed to be stronger, deeper. Players are better. It's supposed to be really hard to differentiate yourself in this era. And yet Scottie Scheffler has somehow managed to do it, not with overwhelming power, not by making every single putt that he looks at, but sort of the good old fashioned way. Crisp ball striking, spin control, distance control, shape and trajectory, varying his speeds, great and tidy wedge play, is sort of being sure-handed around the greens, and certainly a level of clutchness I think was on display over the weekend. The single blemish that he made over the final 36 holes at Royal Portrush was the double that he made on 8, but he just made countless putts when he needed to, while having very sound course management and strategy alongside his caddy, Ted Scott. There's nothing necessarily flashy about it. There's nothing necessarily flamboyant about it. But in an era when everyone was supposed to be bunched together and you're really going to struggle to have a dominant season, Scottie Scheffler has now been doing this for 4 years running. It's simply remarkable.
I love that conversation. I love that concept, because I was walking back to our flat tonight to do this recording. I kept trying to think, what is Scottie Scheffler's superpower? And you're right. It's his ball striking. It's just how he can hit those shots under pressure, almost on command. You very rarely ever seen him just hit an absolutely squirrely shot. And when he lets go of the club, you think it's going to be a squirrely shot, and it ends up being 20 feet from the pin. He's not the kind of player that's going to have the big miss. I will say what happened on number 8 was a bit curious to me, because that was out of character, because that was very much a self-inflicted wound on that front. And he doesn't make mental errors either. So that one surprised me. He actually talked about it when he was talking with a live from crew about the idea that he was coming off of 2 big par saves and he was kind of feeling himself, to be honest. Like, I felt like I was invincible at that point. So why not? Let's give it a shot. And probably pushed himself too far, which is refreshing, because you learn that, oh, wow, he's really human. Going back to the idea of what his superpower is, though, I keep coming around to the idea, and this is not a sexy take, but his superpower is the type of person he is, the DNA that had him when he puts out and wins the Open Championship for the first time. He's going to horse the Clara Jug. It was a little muted, in my opinion. It wasn't until he sort of scanned the area and he saw Meredith and he saw Baby Bennett and he saw his family. He saw Scott, his dad, and his mom and dad, everyone there. That's when you got the emotion. That's when you got the hat being thrown on the ground and the hands in the air. It's such a fascinating tell. And I keep going back to the idea that to be a professional golfer at that level, to be the best of the absolute best, you have to be so selfish. I've made this argument about Tiger Woods in the past before, that it is such a singular focus that you almost have to ignore everything else in your life and push them to the side to make sure that I continue to stay on pace to be the best I can. Clearly, Scotty is doing that, but he's only doing it because of the people around him. He had a really good line in his press conference tonight that I wouldn't be able to do this if it wasn't for Meredith and the people around me and my team and Randy Smith and everyone else who has sort of congregated and made that commitment to be part of that team. I think that's actually his superpower, because he's able to acknowledge it. And you and I both know there are plenty of PGA Tour pros that won't even acknowledge it, probably don't even realize that they're able to do what they do because of this sort of village that's around him. In my mind, that's what makes him so special.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. The stability in his life, I think, is certainly sort of underpinning the success that he's had. I think if you're going to point to what he does better than anybody else, there's a certain relentlessness to Scottie Scheffler. And I certainly think that there's a certain resilience to Scottie Scheffler. Right? We saw something different at the 2025 Open than we had not seen in his 3 prior major championship victories. His major wins on Sunday had sort of been defined by slow starts and then he turned it on late. Like, you think back to the 2022 Masters and the revelation he was crying beforehand, potentially overwhelmed that he wasn't ready for that. He was extremely nervous at that start, did not birdie the par five, all of a sudden had a third hole chip in to settle down, and then he was off the races. 2024 Masters, fast forward 2 years later. Remember, he was one over for the first seven holes and in a log jam with a bunch of other players, ends up making six birdies over his last 11 holes. Just a couple of months ago at the PGA Championship, everyone thinks Scottie Scheffler is going to run away after that torrid run to finish his third round. Remember, went out in two over par, caught by John Rahm, had a near flawless back nine in which he didn't miss hit a shot until the 18th. What we saw on Sunday at the Open was the exact opposite. Hit it to a foot on one, hit to 7 feet on four, hit it to 15 feet on five, and all of a sudden, this was his ball game, and he could afford sort of the rare mistake that he had while making that double bogey. When we talked on Saturday night, the only way that Scottie Scheffler was not going to win this major championship was if he had a sloppy start, if he made some bogeys, that would potentially rattle his confidence, like, again, it had happened in the three prior major championships. Someone behind needed to mount a charge. Neither scenario happened. Scotty was sharp from the get-go, and no one really had a serious threat to his dominance. And I think that's why you had a back nine, which felt Tiger-esque, and the fact that he was just able to plot his way around, fat side of the green, two-putt par, and head home and catch the claret jug.
Yeah, Stuart Sink once told me that when Tiger Woods in his prime would get one of those leads, like we saw from Scottie Scheffler today, he would play quote-unquote prevent defense, which is kind of a hockey term, where everyone else has to come get me. At this point, I don't have to do anything special. I love the fact that Xander Schauffele was talking to the media. Scottie was finishing up the 17th and 18th holes, and he's sort of squinting, sort of looking at the leaderboard and watching the coverage on the TV that's right next to him. And he goes, like, 17 and 18, he can hit irons. Like, of course he can hit driver. He's hitting it well enough. But those two holes, with that commanding of a lead, it just wasn't going to happen. I think we talked about on the mini pod on Saturday night going into Sunday about the idea, and I never looked it up, so if someone wants to send it to me, there had to be a prop bet on what the odds were that Scottie Scheffler was going to shoot an over par round on Sunday at Royal Portrush, because that was the only chance anyone had. To your point, you're right. He had to stumble a little bit coming out of the gates. He had to allow the nerves to get to him. I would
say there had to be some sort of conditions, and there weren't. It was the nicest day.
Well, that would have helped.
70 degrees and at most a 10 mile an hour wind. When the conditions were like that and everyone was going to be bunched, it was just going to be almost impossible for Scottie Scheffler to back up to the field.
Well, and you said someone needed to make a run. I'll even be more specific. Rory McIlroy needed to make a run. He needed to start his round today the way he started it on Saturday and get the crowd behind him. And I went out and walked those first couple holes thinking that this could turn out to be something magical. And in my mind, I was thinking that Rory was probably going to get off to a good start, and Scotty may have started the way he did on Saturday, which wasn't a bad start, but it seemed like he was in neutral, and that didn't happen at all.
I want to get to Rory in a minute, because I think that was a sight that we're probably not going to see for a very long time, if ever. But the discussion now for Scottie Scheffler turns to how many majors. Will it be the one major that he's going to really need next year, the U.S. Open at Shinnecock, to now complete the career Grand Slam? We just had this whole celebration of Rory McIlroy, and all of a sudden, a player with seemingly little scar tissue in terms of Scottie Scheffler could pick off. It could be a fifth or sixth, seventh major by that point, but it would certainly be the one that gives him all four legs. So I'm curious, like, when we sit here right now at the end of the major championship season in 2025, Scottie is 29 years old, very much in the prime of his career. How many majors do you think Scottie's going to wind up with?
The other thought I was taken by on my way back to our beautiful flat here in Portrush was, A, what is Scottie's superpower, and B, what stops him? I mean, outside of a weird pasta accident, in which I don't think anyone wants to count on, outside of maybe an overzealous detective in the Louisville Police Department, I don't think you can really count on that year in and year out. Because let's face it, over the last 3 years, those are the only two things that have really stopped him, if we're being honest. And I don't know if that's sustainable if you're one of the competition.
Detective Gillis, the Scottie Scheffler stopper.
Yes, or him making the poor choice of trying to use a wine glass to cut pasta. I don't think Scottie's going to make that mistake again either. we have seen Scotty have injuries. Go back to the Players' Championship where he had the neck injury and he struggled with it, still ended up winning. There's been nothing in his body of work outside of those two instances that suggest. We had a long conversation at dinner the other night about Will Zalatoris, and you want the best for this player who was clearly very, very talented, but now he has had two back surgeries. Scotty's not in that category. You're not looking at his swing thinking to yourself that, yeah, that's not going to hold up over time. So mark that one off as at least the obvious choice. He's not going to get injured. He's not going to get bored because clearly he might get bored 2 minutes after winning the Open Championship, which apparently I would be curious if he did, but he's driven to win the Masters or to win the FedEx Cup or to win the Ryder Cup. Like it's the chase that he seems to love the most. And that's not going to go away. It's not his family. Baby Bennett's been around for a year now and he doesn't seem to be slowing down. So tell me what's going to slow him down on my long-winded answer to, I don't know that there is a cap
50
right now. No, well, I'm not going to be ridiculous. Like, let's be honest. I think 15 is not in the wheelhouse. Let's be honest, but
why not?
Well, yeah, I guess that would be the obvious question. I mean, because 15 is the magical number. There's only two numbers right now when it comes to this. It's 18 and 15. I mean, that's it. And I also had this conversation with Todd Lewis as we were waiting to do live from tonight, that in a weird way, we celebrated Rory winning the career Grand Slam so much. And it's because it hadn't happened in over two decades. Tiger Woods had been the last person to do it more than two decades ago. This is a generational thing that happens. If somehow Scotty's able to do it next year at Shinnecock, and let's face it, I mean, he's going to be the favorite going into that U.S. Open, it almost dumbs it down to the point. Like, we're going to have to explain to fans that this doesn't happen every year. There's only so many faces on Mount Rushmore of golf, and in back-to-back years, we're going to have two people. That, to me, is shocking.
It's certainly shocking. And to your point, Scotty does seem built for the long haul, not just with his golf swing, not just what he does particularly well, not just because of the steadiness of sort of his off-course life as well. I think when you put all of that together, you're looking at a player who can continue to do this for 10 to 15 years. And we've seen players have spurts, right, to pick off all of their or most of their major championships. Spieth had a spurt. Koepka had a spurt. DJ had a spurt. At least until the Masters this year, Rory McIlroy had a spurt. This doesn't seem like a spurt for Scottie Scheffler. And I think when you look and sort of forecast to predict and look ahead for Scottie, like, he's the best iron player in the world. There is no tournament on the planet that emphasizes that attribute more than Augusta National does. Scottie was fourth this year at the Masters with nowhere near his best stuff. And Roy McIlroy even admitted as much, that he picked off his three wins in early 2025 when Scottie was still sort of recovering and getting into game mode after that sort of random and fluky injury. The PGA Championship is a complete examination of a player's skills. Like, going to Ronimic next year just outside Philadelphia, like, a complete examination. This guy is the best driver of the golf ball. He's the best iron player, elite scrambler, now an above average putter. That sounds like a complete examination to me. US Open, I think, historically is going to be setup dependent. If it's a driving test, Scotty can do that well. If it's a scrambling test, I think he can perform the well. He has sort of all of the mental strength and temperament and steadiness to excel in that championship. And I think his record reflects that. Had a great opportunity despite missing virtually every putt inside 10 feet on those notoriously treacherous greens just last month at Oakmont. And obviously the Open, particularly when it's calm, as it was for three of the 4 days here at Portrush, is a ball strikers examination. Yeah. And with the skills that he has, with the emphasis on and the importance of ball control, like, Scotty can do there. That's a long way of saying I think he's probably going to get to 10. I don't see any reason, barring an injury, barring some sort of life change or lack of desire that would somehow be stricken him. Like, I think he can probably get to 10, which is outrageous to think in this era.
Well done, because you got to an answer. So I guess I was thinking, did 10. That's probably a good one to do. And we have had this conversation before, I think, in context of him when Scotty won the PGA Championship. And you started thinking about the career Grand Slam. I think my take that I leaned into was, well, the Open Championship will be the toughest one because of the variables, all the unpredictability that comes with links golf. Outside of Thursday, we didn't necessarily have that. We're going to have a conversation about Bryson DeChambeau later. It was pretty much 3 days of ideal conditions. There was a little bit of wind, but nothing really that you come to expect when it comes to the Open Championship. So he had that going for him, But once you seem to clear this hurdle, and I still believe in the idea that of the four major championships, this is probably the hardest one. Even if you're Scottie Scheffler, even if you can tick all those boxes that you just pointed out, that I'm the best driver of the golf ball, I'm the best iron player, I'm probably among the best people when it comes to putting right now in the game. You can tick all those boxes all you want. When you get here, you end up with a bad bounce. You end up on the bad side of the draw, whatever the case may be. We saw it happen to Tiger Woods many times in his prime, and now he's dusted that one off.
So there is one thing I wanted to get into as it relates to Scotty, because you're old. You covered peak Tiger. When Tiger was in his heyday, I was still in high school. I was still in college. I did not get to experience it. I did not get to cover it. And I'm always curious, like, how golf writers covered Tiger's majors. And we always remember the highlight reel shots and the excitement and whipping the crowd to a frenzy. But a lot of those, he just sort of snuffed all of the excitement and drama out of them with just really methodical, plodding play. And I think we saw a glimpse Sunday night here in the press tent, if we want to go behind the scenes here, of what it might be like for Scotty.
Golf writers sleeping?
Well, not necessarily sleeping, but I thought when you listen to Scotty Scheffler's press conference on Sunday night here at Port Rush, that might be the fewest number of actual golf questions that have ever been asked of a winner on Sunday night at a major. There was nothing like what happened on 8. There was one question about 16 because he only made par on Sunday after birding at the first three rounds at Calamity Corner, a 230-yard par 3 that he made look like a pitch and putt. Like, people are looking for something else. I think a lot of it stemmed from the press conference that he had on Tuesday when he was sort of spiraling in some sort of existential dread. But I'm curious your thought on that and if there's any sort of parallels to Tiger where when the golf becomes monotonous and winning becomes monotonous, that you're just sort of grasping for straws and angles as it relates to Scotty Scheffler now.
Well, and Tiger never gave us the gold mine that was the press conference earlier this week. That what's the point? Like, we never heard those words come out of Tiger's mouth. The point was to win. He showed up every single week to win. And there were plenty of times when it did feel like Sunday, where it did feel like it was a foregone conclusion. I'll even go back to Saturday night. And I tried to play the other side of the fence to my detriment, because I think you beat me up. I think the folks beat me up on the podcast a little bit because you seemed to think it was over. And I gave it the idea that, well, it's 18 holes.
Spoiler alert, it was.
It was over, but anything can happen in 18 holes. Well, no, he ripped the rug out right from under us on that one. I will say Tiger Woods in his prime gave us plenty of examples of exciting Sunday golf. And I'll go to 2008 at Torrey Pines. There was nothing mundane. There was nothing boring about that. Certainly when he went head-to-head with Y.E. Yang at the PGA Championship, which he ended up losing that one. But there were plenty of times when he gave us something to pay attention to. And the golf was so compelling. That's where the focus on. I think the difference on this one, and it goes back to that press conference earlier in the week, as I don't even want to say mundane, as human as Scotty can be sometimes, as the guy next door as he can be sometimes. He's the guy you want to have beer with and grill out with on a Sunday afternoon. He's not necessarily a player that you want to sit down and have a long interview with about the deep thoughts of the game, or even sort of the nuts and bolts if you wanted to go golf nerd on him. I don't even know if he would necessarily play that game. We have a very good friend in Mark Schlabel at ESPN that tried to take a deep dive last year when he hit the shank at East Lake, and he didn't get a very friendly answer out of him on that one. So it's not as though he's willing to go into the nuts and bolts of it well. So I see why a lot of writers turn to, okay, you said this on Wednesday. How does it apply today? I think that's actually going to follow him for quite a long time, and I'm sure Scotty's thinking to himself now, like, why in the world would I have said that? But it did offer a glimpse into exactly what drives him.
I got to get this off my chest.
Please.
Because I know it went viral. I know it was clipped everywhere. I know it's prompted a lot of discussion and conversation. And people keep getting caught and hung up on his comments from Tuesday. All Scotty Scheffler was saying was what he has always said, which is what he had said for the past couple years, is that my priorities are my faith and my family, and golf comes third after that. Yes, it took him 5 minutes to get there. Yes, he had some sort of existential dread of what's the point? And he seemed like he was in some sort of crisis. But that's perfectly fine when someone has clearly struck the right balance between really caring about something, which he does with golf, and also not being consumed by it, which I think it's safe to say that Scotty Scheffler doesn't. He works hard. He loves hard. But what I do think is interesting when he was asked repeatedly about this is that Scotty kept coming back to the fact that he does not think about winning golf tournaments. And I think that actually is apropos now because there's so many Tiger comps that have come out, not just because of dominance, but sort of the stretch in which he has done it, just a limited number of years. And I think Scotty, if that's true, that he doesn't really think about winning golf tournaments, he just thinks about his process and getting him in the position to win golf tournaments. I actually think that is apropos now because he's in a healthier spot than maybe Tiger Woods was with Jack Nicklaus, where there's clearly a target and he kept going for it and he was trying to compare himself in sort of measuring himself against Jack Nicklaus. I think it was probably a better spot than Rory McIlroy was with Tiger Woods, who idolized him, boyhood idol, wanted to get to 14 majors or wherever Tiger Woods was going to end up. I think there was even a little bit of that sort of target mentality with Brooks Koepka, who Rory McIlroy was the best player of that generation. Brooks Koepka wanted desperately to edge him in front of the majors, got five, and now Rory, the 2025 Masters, did that as well. Yes, Scottie Scheffler says, I have dreams and aspirations. We still don't really know what those are. He's never verbalized those to us in the media, but it's about the work to get there. To me, that's such a healthier way to look at it than being consumed by tournaments and being consumed by trophies and the number of wins and trying to check off goals that way. It's very process oriented. And to me, that's a little bit healthier than maybe some of the other superstars who have been sort of target oriented.
I mean, getting driven by the journey is certainly the healthiest way you could do it. I think it's easy to say that right now. I would go back and say I didn't cover Jack Nicklaus, but my guess is given how much he wanted to lean into his family and how much his family was important to him compared to what he was doing on the golf course, I don't know that he would have ever said what's the point, but I think deep down inside they're driven by the same mechanisms. That it's not necessarily the winning. I remember a story a few years ago that, again, Doug Ferguson, our friend at AP, did. The question was really simple. Do you love winning more than you hate losing? And as he was reporting this story, I was taken by how many players would think about it and go, I hate losing more. And that's really, I think, a bit fundamentally what drives Scotty. When you saw him last week, we saw him a couple times last week at the Scottish Open, on the greens, just show complete frustration. And you're less than a week removed and you are absolutely lapping the field here at what should be the much, much harder test. I think it's that. It was what happened last week drove him to show up this week. And I have to do it better this week. I think that's the element that you're absolutely right. He has said this on numerous occasions. He's always said, it's always family. It's always faith. It's always the things outside of golf that I'm going to be driven by. And again, I was a little taken by specifically over here in the United Kingdom, how his comments were taken in a negative light. Because when I heard them, I kept thinking to myself, I don't think he understands how emotionally healthy those comments are.
Exactly. And like he's clearly going to savor this Open title more than 2 minutes, which is what he sort of off as just the show goes on. Yes, the show goes on for Scottie Scheffler. He does have the next 2 weeks off. Then we'll see him in Memphis. And if he doesn't win, who knows? Probably critique his game and wonder what's exactly wrong with Scottie Scheffler. That was 28 and a half minutes on Scottie and his triumph at Royal Portrush. I would argue, though, Rex, the bigger star on property in this home game, first time since 2019, was Rory McIlroy. Yeah. I was out there. You were out there. As one typically does with Rory, you're sort of gaming out what could possibly happen on Sunday that would see him with a potential chance. Maybe he goes 400 for the first seven. Maybe Scotty hits a wild hook out of bounds on the first tee. All of a sudden, we've got a 2022 Tour Championship where Rory McIlroy flipped that six-shot deficit and turned it into a FedEx Cup title. Instead, he shot a 69, tied for seventh. What do you make of Rory's Sunday and overall his week at home?
Really good transition because I think emotionally healthy is the way I would go on this one. Because you go back to 2019, and Rory has talked a lot about the idea that he was consumed by waiting for this Open to come here. It's a home Open. He mentioned today that he actually thinks he's got two more bites at the apple of an Open at Port Rust. That seems to me to be a little
aggressive. Ambitious.
Yes, because that means you're going to be playing some of your best golf, probably at best in your mid-50s, and you're going to be coming into here. I don't know if that's going to happen, because it seems like Port Rust is going to be on that 10-year window like every other Open venue is. That's not to knock Port Rust. It's a great venue, but only St. Andrews gets that once every five-year treatment, and then you work the other ones in. I'll go back to 2019, and Rory has been very open about the idea that showing up on that first tee was a shock. He didn't anticipate what that was going to be like. He didn't know what it was going to be like to have an entire country weighing down on your shoulders, and he tried to hide from it 6 years ago, and that clearly did not work. I love the idea that he came into it this week not wanting to hide from him. You and I both, we walked enough with him this week. He didn't. He embraced everything along the way. He signed autographs. He talked to the media. He seemed to love every step of the process. You're not going to get a player that's of the caliber like Rory McIlroy, who is going to finish up on a Sunday afternoon, never really having a chance to win. Finished inside the top 10, had a decent week, tell you that I accomplished everything I wanted to this week. Granted, didn't take the Claret Jug home, would have loved to have done that, but I accomplished everything I wanted to do. That's a guy that made the most of this opportunity, knowing that you're not going to get this very often.
Sunday was a little bit flat, yeah, for the final round for Rory McIlroy, but that Saturday atmosphere was among the most special of any that I've covered. You know, Rory shot 66 on Saturday, made the bomb on one to sort of set the tone for the day, made the bomb on 12 that he said was one of the loudest roars that he'd ever heard. It was like a sun splash summer festival of like 45,000 people, all of whom were trying to will the local hero to victory. Now, like a day removed, and I'm writing this up for NBCSports.com/golf, otherwise known as golfchannel.com. There was no edginess to Rory McIlroy's comments when he met with the media on Saturday night. Like, he wasn't giddy. He wasn't anticipating like a Sunday charge. He probably knew that this was over, that he had spotted the world number one, the best player in golf, six shots, and it was probably going to be too much to overcome, particularly with the favorable forecast on tap. And so what I think we saw this weekend was someone who was less fraught, less tense, less burdened, and he sort of shifted the narrative into not necessarily having this Open at Port Rust be a monument to his greatness or his dominance, but it was really a celebration of what he's been able to accomplish in his career. And he, I think, really enjoyed soaking up the adulation from all the fans, the standing ovation. I watched a bunch of kids slap his hands along the rope line and they just started crying. He had fans who were standing atop the dunes who were bellowing and chanting his name. Like, it was a really, really cool scene. And I think you contrast that with 3 months ago. He was so locked in at the Masters, not paying attention to anyone or anything. Here he was engaging. Here he was appreciative. And I don't know if we'll ever see an atmosphere like that again, at least in recent memory. Like, okay, Tommy Fleetwood's going to have a home game next year at Birkdale. It's not going to be like this. Okay. Scottie Scheffler's going to have a home game in 2 years, the PGA Championship at Frisco. It's not going to be like this. You know, Rory resonates in different ways. And that's what I'm sort of exploring for the website on Sunday night. You know, he didn't necessarily end the year with a fairy tale at home, but I do think that Rory put on a show that he could be really proud of. And I think that's going to be one of my enduring takeaways from this week.
And again, I would equate this to the long conversation we just had about Scotty. He finds joy. He finds satisfactions in things other than lifting trophies. I think in this particular case, Rory was able to transform himself to a spot that I don't have to lift a Claret Jug on Sunday to make the most of this experience.
Yeah, I think that's perfectly fair to say. A memorable week for Scotty. Certainly a memorable week for Rory McIlroy as well. Coming after this short break, we'll have a fun stock watch segment. Which players improve their stock with either the FedEx Cup, Ryder Cup, world ranking, and the like, which players are on the downslide. Plenty more this podcast coming up after this short break. All right, Rex, longtime golfchannel.com readers will remember this. Stockwatch, the weekly segment I used to do every single week for the website. It's pretty simple. Players who improved their stock and players who declined after this Open Championship. You can go first. Which players are on the upswing?
Why don't you do stock watch anymore?
You know, changing priorities. Got to do this podcast all of a sudden. Who knows?
Yeah, I get it. I'm going to start with the guy I think made up the most ground, and it's Harris English. And he ended up finishing second. That's his second runner-up finish in a major championship this year. He is safely on the Ryder Cup team. That is not a discussion that I think we need to have. I think the bigger picture is Harris English is turning himself into a major player. He's turning himself into the type of player that you should anticipate to see regularly on leaderboards at the biggest events. I'll be curious to see what he does in the playoffs, because again, he seems to be hitting his stride at the perfect time of year.
I mean, he was 10th in the Ryder Cup standings heading into the Open Championship. Yeah. Now runner-up finishes in a pair of major championships on totally disparate tracks. I'm with you. Harris English is going to be on that U.S. Ryder Cup team as well. He should. How about Chris Goddard, Rex? I mean, this is a player who, you know, a lot was maybe expected out of college, former Haskins winner as a top player in all of college golf. A little bit of a slow burn, won an opposite field event in 2024. Now he looks like a primetime player. Won the Scottish Open, a golf tournament that you were covering, finished third in the Open Championship. I think now when you look at sort of the totality of Chris Goddard's season, like, it's awfully good. 8 top 25 finishes. He's a winner. And I think with his skill set being full send all the time, second on the PGA Tour in total driving distance with all the drives factored in, like, yeah. I think he was potentially be a great fit for Bethpage Black if we get to a situation over these next couple weeks where Keegan Bradley is going to sort of recuse himself and just be a captain. I think Chris Goddard makes a lot of sense as one of those top 12 players. And the way that he's playing right now, I don't think many Americans would quibble with that. Who else you got?
I'm going to take back a comment I made last week after he won on the Sunday night podcast. And I think I called Chris Goddard up a working man's Brooks Koepka. Did I get that right?
Mm-hmm. That's one.
I'm just going to say a new version of Brooks Koepka. Just go with that. I apologize. I probably shouldn't have gone out on that limb like that. I'm very, very sorry. And I also want to point out, a friend of mine was texting me earlier tonight about this and get caught up in the Scottie Scheffler and Rory situation. You look what Chris has done the last 2 weeks. That is a perfect example of why meritocracy matters. Because it wasn't that long ago when Chris Goddard was probably the guy on the outside looking in. When you talk about the signature events, when you talk about, he didn't get into the Scottish Open until the Thursday before he was at the John Deere. He wasn't in that field. That got him into this field. Now, everything has changed going into next season. Now, he's pretty much a lock to get into the, all those signature events. So it will be fun to see how he can take advantage.
No one, Rex, like, regenerates stars like the PGA Tour does.
Exactly.
And I think that's the benefit of full field events. You have to have players who are outside sort of that signature event bubble to pop. Chris Goddard has certainly done that this summer.
And not to spiral this into another conversation, it seems apropos given the fact that LIV Golf just applied for world ranking points again, and maybe they get them, maybe they don't. Maybe they have submitted something to the world ranking that's a different version of what they submitted last time that was deemed, nope, that's not going to work. We need something more with the meritocracy. We need to see more promotion, more relegation. However, this is an example of why you have to see it, because you have to have fresh faces. You have to give newcomers a better opportunity, a better avenue. So, yeah, you're exactly right. I'm going to go on the downside of the stock watch. Patrick Cantlay missed the cut this week. He has not played his best golf really this season, and he's not playing his best golf at the worst possible time. If Harris English, the Bulldog, is doing it at the best possible time, I think Patrick Cantlay is doing it at the worst time, because he's given Keegan Bradley a reason not to put him on that team. Now, I still think Patrick will get on that team, but he needs to have some good performances over the next few weeks to do it.
Yeah, he's played pretty well in the signature events in the PGA Tour. He's got 8 top 15 finishes this season, but his major championship record in 2025, just a completely lost year. 3 missed cuts, 36 in the Masters was his best finish. I think I would still put Patrick Cantlay on that U.S. Ryder Cup team, but it's almost exclusively based on his past record, at least in the last 4 team competitions. 12-4-1, he's essentially the American Ian Poulter. And I don't think on a team that's probably going to have some fresh faces, I think going back to a player,
I don't think I would ever make that comparison, but okay.
And his skill set, I think, does make a lot of sense. Along those same lines, I'm going with Brooks Koepka. 3 missed cuts in the major championships for the first time in his career. He's barely a top 100 player in the world, according to Data Golf. His iron play in particular has fallen off a cliff. He's 35 years old. His swing coach, who's been with him forever, Pete Cowan, made some allusion on the broadcast to a potential knee issue as it relates to Brooks Koepka, but has not been competitive on LIV Golf. There was a lot of talk a couple of months ago that, you know, if Keegan Bradley wanted to pick two LIV players, it was going to be Bryson DeChambeau, who's probably going to qualify on his own merits and qualify automatically, and Brooks Koepka, based on the big game Brooks, his history at Bethpage Black winning the 2019 PGA Championship, the way that he has played this summer, complete non-starter, complete non-factor. Brooks Koepka is not going to be on the team, should not be anywhere close to the discussions. Anybody else in your stock down?
You mentioned not down, up. I'm going to go with DeChambeau because he did have a solid week. And he talked a lot about it coming into this week that he has just not learned how to play links golf. And it has a lot to do with his style of play. He spins the ball a lot. He launches the ball very high. He has a tendency to have a game plan and not deviate from that. So he came into this week with a different game plan. Instead of hitting shots that were going to ride the wind, he was going to try to control his golf ball a little bit more, hold it up against the wind. I will say on Thursday, he 100% absolutely did not do that. Thursday, again, were the worst conditions of the week. We actually had real Open Championship weather on Thursday. But when things calmed down on Thursday, Friday, and Sunday, he actually played very well, posted his second top 10 finish ever in this championship, kind of left here feeling like he made some progress. Again, I will rewind and point out that he played his best golf on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday when the conditions were very, very good. He still has to learn how to play in difficult conditions. That's not a criticism. There are tons and tons of players who have to come to that epiphany. There are tons and tons of players that need multiple tries to figure this out. We had a long conversation about Phil Mickelson. It took him a long time to finally figure out the Open Championship links golf equation. And when he did, he struck magic at Muirfield. So I'm not saying that Bryson's not going to do it. And I feel like he made some progress this week, but he still has a ways to go.
Yeah, and Bryson agrees. Like, if he wants to be a complete player, he has to learn to play on this side of the pond. He has to learn links golf, particularly when the conditions are challenging. He also had a top 10 finish at St. Andrews in 2022, just like it was this week at Portrush. Very favorable for scoring, benign conditions. Was able to capitalize that way with sort of his aerial attack. That's a good one. I would go Matt Fitzpatrick, who is clearly out of the wilderness, has gotten better in each of his last five starts, his last three in particular. Very, very good. Top eights and all of those. Looks like his ball striking under the tutelage of Mark Blackburn, who he began working with just after the Masters at the RBC Heritage, has clearly taken hold. He said the Players' Championship was the lowest point of his entire career, had really no direction. I think it's pretty clear he's on the upswing at this point. Look for him to be on the European Ryder Cup team as well. One quick stock down, pains me to say so, Jordan Spieth. This week, at the Open Championship, tied for 40th, was really looking for a good result for a couple of reasons. A, wanted to improve his Ryder Cup standing. He was 26th in the U.S. team after not earning virtually any points in 2024 while battling that wrist injury, but also 48th, most critically, in the FedEx Cup. That is very close to the cutoff point for the BMW Championship and trying to get to the signature events for 2026. Spieth added that he's probably going to have to pick up another start, likely the Wyndham Championship, to improve his FedEx Cup standing, try and get away from that bubble and make sure he's not subject to some of the criticism that he had for receiving a sponsor exemption. Please, the sausage fingers up. That means the floor is yours.
No, you added an extra one, so I'm going to do an OLI outside looking in. I'm going to go with P. Reed. You talked about some other LIV guys who were trying to get in. This was his one week. This was his one chance to try to impress Keegan Bradley, and he's not going to make that team.
Maybe it's fair. Maybe it's not. You and I are at least dealing in reality, and Patrick Reed will not be on that team. After this short break, some more fun Love It or Lab It segment, as well as parting thoughts from our week at Royal Portrush. Thanks for listening. All right, Rex, let's end this pod with some Love It or Lab It. You know the rules. Either love something or you hate on it, a.k.a. you lab it. Let's begin with Royal Portrush hosting the Open Championship for the second time in 6 years. Are you loving or laving Portrush as an open venue?
Love it, love it, love it, love it. Can't say it enough times. Let's face it. It took 68 years to come back to Royal Portrush. And I think last time in 2019, it proved not only is it a great golf course, identifies great champions. You have Shane Lowry. Now you have Scottie Scheffler. You look at that leaderboard. It was a great mix. You had the world number one and the world number two in the mix. And then Chris Gauthier. and Harris English and so many other players, Hao Tung Li, who hadn't done much in the major championships. It is a great test of golf. But beyond that, I think it's a great location. And it took a while for the RNA to come around. And there were some logistical issues they had to work through. There were some issues in the town. It's a very small place. But once you get here, and I make the argument all the time that St. Andrews is the best major venue in all of golf. It was like it was built, purpose-built, 400 and whatever years ago to host major championships in the modern era. I would say this little town is right behind it.
Great golf course, great build out, great atmosphere, certainly fueled by Rory McIlroy's charge. I certainly would have loved to see it though with some conditions. That was the big differentiator in 2019. Lowry shot 63 in that third round to pull away. Remember that hellacious rain that we had on Sunday? Lowry's the only player to finish double digits under par. The setup this week, there was a lot of rough in spots, but didn't seem to necessarily come into play. And I thought you saw a lot of recoveries, which is fine, and it's great. But you didn't necessarily see the horror shows that you typically see at other Lynx golf courses, where balls dive into gorse and all of a sudden it's unplayable, and you're making a big number that way. I do love the wild undulations and slopes on the greens. The RNA, I think, was very cognizant of the fact, tucking a lot of pins behind the slopes and mounds, trying to make sure that the scoring did not get out of control. As it relates to Royal Portrush, absolutely loving it. Don't want to see it though every 6 years. I think that's fair to say.
10 years.
Second topic.
We can do 10 years.
Yeah, that's fine. Shane Lowry was assessed, Rex, a two-shot penalty after officials determined that his ball moved ever so slightly in the second round. Are you loving or laving that infraction and the subsequent penalty?
I'm taking a page out of your book on this one. I'm loving and laving it. I'm loving the idea that he violated the rules. And I saw it live on TV. And this goes back to the naked eye rule. The idea that you can only see something in super slow motion if it's zoomed in. Yes, of course not. That's where we had to draw the line. That's where Goff drew the line. I saw this in real time. At normal speeds, it moved. And it moved because he swung too close to it or caught a piece of grass the wrong way, whatever the case may be. That's the first penalty. He was not assessed a two-stroke penalty. He was assessed 2 one-stroke penalties. This is where Goff needs to get it right. That, okay, he moved the ball and he should have gotten a penalty. The idea that he didn't see it and he got another penalty because then he played from the wrong position because he didn't replace it. That's ridiculous. It's counterintuitive. Goff needs to fix this. Goff has gotten better over the last few years of sort of getting out of its own way when it comes to rules of golf, but it needs to do something about this.
I'm with you on this. Like, if the ball moves, it moves. I'm fine with that. It clearly moved. The officials sort of had that gotcha moment in the scoring trail. Like, look, it clearly moved. You need to accept this. And there was a 20-30 minute discussion where he was clearly frustrated with that was the outcome, and he didn't want to be labeled a quote cheat if he was fighting and didn't necessarily accept it. What does seem superfluous though, to your point, is that if you don't know it moves, of course you're going to play it from the wrong spot. And that just seems like an unnecessary stroke. Seems like an easy fix. Not sure why they haven't done it. That's the thing I'd like to see amended. Third and final topic for Love It or Lave It, Phil Mickelson. Doubling back on this from March, are you loving or laving that this take from Phil, which he uncorked again in mid-March before Scottie Scheffler won, is the worst take of all time?
First and foremost, I will say chef kiss. Like, I love the idea that Phil Mickelson or anyone else is going to go out on a limb and do that kind of take. This has you written all over it. You love these types of hot takes because normally they don't come back to bite you. Normally you can say something on the podcast a year ago and no one's going to circle back around and be like, well, Lav said that Harris English was never going to finish second at the Open Championship. Normally we can get away with it and we can move forward. I did not get away with it. You and I did not get away with it last week when we said this is the best fortnight and all of professional golf. Scottish Open last week, played on the Lynx golf course in Scotland.
Stand by it. I stand by it.
I stand by it too. However, I have come around to the idea that, well, it looks like Pebble Beach and Riviera are going to be played back-to-back next year. That one's pretty good. I had to be corrected. I had to be reminded by a friend of mine that the Masters and Hilton Head are probably the best 2 weeks of the year, in my opinion, because you have the intensity of the first major followed by what is really a relaxing week. So that's a good 1-2 combo. It's both sweet and sour, just the way we like our chicken. So I would say that this take is, well, it's clearly wrong and he needs to be called on it. However, as someone who is in the hot take business, I certainly have a level of sympathy for him, but yes, that is the worst take ever.
I don't think it's the worst take ever. Shoot or shoot. Phil Mickelson, as we have seen over the past three decades, shoots more than most. I don't want to see all of a sudden these players be, to use the term, gun shy, because they're essentially going to get called out by old takes exposed. Come on, Phil. You love to see it. Keep on corking hot takes, and we'll keep using them on the show. All right, just a couple minutes left in this recap edition from the Open Championship. Rex, what are some of your final thoughts, your parting thoughts from the week that was in Portrush?
Well, I kind of look back on the way this fit now fits into the rotation. And there was a lot of talk earlier in the week, and not to get lost in the weeds because we did this on Wednesday, but you have some new venues, this being one of them. There's a lot of talk about Portmonic, which is another great links course here in Ireland that it could be added to the rotation. I love all of these ideas because certainly coming here 6 years ago was a huge success, and you and I could not have been more effusive about how this should stay in the rotation. However, there's only so many spots, and so something is going to have to give. Turnberry would be the one that everyone wants to talk about for a lot of different reasons. I go to Muirfield because, having gone there the last few years, it's been 13 years since we've been back to Muirfield, and I would say that's far too long. That's probably at least 3 years too long, in my opinion. So I think the RNA is going to have to tighten it up a little bit. I appreciate them coming to new venues. Certainly here is a great example. And if you wanted to add a Portmonic, I certainly understand that, but something's going to have to give.
We had a couple of memorable moments, a couple indelible images.
Oof, take
we
it
had
easy.
We had our media center nose picker that appeared on our Saturday night record on YouTube.
Not
we had
cool,
Bennett
man.
Scheffler face planting on the side of the 18th green. We had Rory McIlroy amidst the sun-drenched crowd on 17, eliciting some cheers. But to me, Rex, the Scotty dominance is obviously going to be what the biggest takeaway from this week was. Mm-hmm. But I think the communal aspect of the Open Championship is why it's my favorite golf tournament to cover. The 20 to 25-minute walk that you and I had at the golf course with thousands of fellow event goers is always memorable. The walk downtown for a proper pint of Guinness, where I learned that it's not about splitting the G, but it's actually about splitting the harp just the and harp. The letters.
Yep.
I had plenty of experience doing that this week. It was a great week with you at Portrush, a great week for all of you that were listening. We certainly appreciate the support on the mini pods, preview pod, and of course, the recap pod. Now, for more on the Open Championship, you guys know the drill, nbcsports.com/golf for all latest news, notes, and updates. Rex and I'll be back on Wednesday, despite our family vacations. Talk to you then. Thanks for listening. Thanks for the support. Talk to you guys in a couple of days.